Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Paris Alston, and this is a special edition of Radio Boston. All this hour, we'll be talking about movies. Coming up, film critic Ty Burr gives us his favorites.
It's actually been a really good year. I'm trying to put together my 10 best list for the year, and it has about 25 movies on it now.
Also, Crazy Rich Asians. Why did a rom-com resonate so deeply?
This is a Hollywood film made for the American audience, the world audience, in the masses. And to see people that look like myself, that people that look like my daughters on screen was so powerful.
And Bo Burnham talks about why his movie Eighth Grade had to be a different kind of story about adolescence.
Kids are experiencing something different than I experienced in 2003 or someone experienced in another decade because of technology and because of the culture.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go.
I'm Paris Alston. Welcome to a special edition of Radio Boston.
To get ourselves a treat.
Whether you celebrated Christmas or not, we hope your day was filled with family, friends, food, and joy. For some of us, it's back to work today, or to begin other celebrations, like Kwanzaa. For many of us, it's also a time to relax a little bit and catch up on the movies we've been meaning to see, whether it be at the movie theater or snuggled up at home with your favorite streaming service, like I will be. So we're going to spend this hour talking about movies that made a cultural impression. We'll revisit our conversations about the breakout film Crazy Rich Asians and the rich coming-of-age film Eighth Grade. But before those, we want to speak with our favorite film critic, the Boston Globe's Ty Burr, about the movies we should be trying to catch this holiday season. Ty, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Paris. Thanks for having me.
So, Ty, I know there's a lot to see at the theater this holiday season, but tell me, what are you looking forward to the most?
You know, it's actually been a really good year. I'm trying to put together my 10 best list for the year, and it has about 25 movies on it now. One of the ones that is really quite wonderful is called If Beale Street Could Talk, which is the follow-up movie by Barry Jenkins, who won the Best Picture for Moonlight. It's based on a James Baldwin novel, all reasons to see it. It's a lovely, lovely, heartbreaking, affirming piece of work, gorgeously shot, beautiful score, tremendous performances. Mm-hmm. I really recommend it.
Yeah, that's one that I'm actually really interested in for a number of reasons, among them being that I'm a huge James Baldwin fan. And we have a clip from the trailer, so let's take a listen.
We've known Bonnie all his life. He's about to pay for something he didn't do. Remember, love is what brought you here. And if you trusted love this far, don't panic now.
So, Ty, of course, as you mentioned, this comes from director Barry Jenkins. Yeah. It follows his Oscar award-winning film Moonlight. How do you think it kind of plays into the narrative, his artistic narrative that he tells with the stories he's telling?
I think he is one of the filmmakers that is telling stories of African-American life that we haven't seen on film before. We read it in literature. There's a scene early in If Beale Street Could Talk where the central family is sitting around talking about a particular family crisis in a way that is dramatized, in a way I've never seen before on screen, that is so full of family feeling, that feels so specific and so universal. Everything about it, from the music to the cinematography to the performances. There's a supporting performance here by Brian Tyree Henry, who's all over the place these days. He's Paperboy in Atlanta. He's in Widows. He does a voice for the new Spider-Man animated movie. But the scene, he has a couple of scenes in If Beale Street Could Talk that are worthy of whatever awards you want to throw at it. Same with Regina King as the hero's mother, the main character's mother.
Yes, and we heard some of her here in that clip we played from the trailer. You know, Ty, I mentioned that my love for James Baldwin is one reason that I want to see this movie. Mm-hmm. And And part of that is because when I think of him, I think of how poetic and sometimes prophetic his words are. And do you think that translates on screen with this movie?
Absolutely. The poetry of his writing. And I'm personally, I've read a lot of his essays. I've never really delved into his novels, so this was kind of eye-opening for me. It's absolutely a poetic movie in its cinematography. The colors just glow in the way the narration weaves in and out, in the way that Nicholas Britell's music really lifts the entire project up. Is it prophetic? Absolutely. I mean, the thing about Baldwin, you know, you read him today and he's speaking to this exact moment. He was just writing 40 years ago. I think that's, you know, this is a story that is set in the late 60s, early 70s. It's kind of hard to pinpoint the exact year, but it is a conversation that we're still having today.
Right, because one of the parts of the story here is that the son and this the young man in the couple, and he's going to be a father-to-be, he and his girlfriend, companion there, they're looking to get married, but those plans kind of come to a halt because he's arrested for a crime he didn't commit.
That's correct.
That's kind of the whole central focus of the story that Baldwin is telling and that we're still talking
right.
about today.
And that incarceration reality is that sort of undercurrent to the movie. But what sort of lies on top of it is this poetic bliss of the couple's relationship. And again, the family life that sort of it supports her, the main female character played by Kiki Layne.
So I want to talk about another one, Roma. It's an international film, and it's directed by Alfonso Cuarón. So tell us a bit about the story this movie tells.
So Alfonso Cuarón is a curious cat. He came out of Mexico with Y Tu Mama Tambien, a conquered Hollywood with Gravity, you know, which won Best Picture. Now he's gone back to Mexico, and he's, you know, on the surface, I joke that this is the best movie a man has ever made about his nanny, which, you know, sounds like I'm putting it down when actually I'm not. It's the best movie anybody has ever made about that relationship that a family has with somebody who's intimately part of their life yet is essentially working for them. It's set in Mexico City in 1970. It's black and white. It's widescreen. It was picked up for distribution by Netflix, and you can see it right now on Netflix. If you can at all get to a movie theater to see this on a big screen, I would urge you to see Roma on a big screen. It is one of the most gorgeous looking films of the year. But it is essentially about this character named Cleo, who is sort of the lowest person on this middle-class Mexico City's family's hierarchy. She's played by a first-time actress named Yalitza Aparicio, who's tremendous. And it's about the family as well. One of the things I liked about it is that often when you see a movie about this sort of situation and The Help springs to mind, it is through the eyes of one of the characters who's in a privileged position, a white or upper class character. This movie does not do that. This movie sees it through Cleo's eyes and really sort of through the omniscient eyes of the camera and Cuarón and the audience. And it charts a couple of years that are tough in her life, in the family's life, and in the life of Mexico City, because there are student protests and crackdowns in the street. All of that is interweaved really masterfully by Cuarón. It's quite a movie.
You mentioned there that this is kind of a must-see in theaters because of how beautiful it is on the big screen.
Yes.
And I was debating, you know, I could go to the movie theater and see it, or I could just stay in the comfort of my living room, watch it in my PJs.
You know, for one thing, you know, I don't want to do this snobbishness thing. If you can't see it in a theater, see it any way you can. I would urge you not to do what Netflix head Reed Hastings has suggested, that and watch it on your phone. He says it looks great on your phone. Please do not watch Roma on your phone. Please do not watch any movie on your phone. Do yourself, do the filmmakers a favor. Nevertheless, like I said, if you can see it on a screen, you will appreciate it all the more because it's gorgeous. And the cinematography transports you to another world, and it's great to have that wrap around your head instead of being, you know, looking at your phone and, you know, having your dog interrupt you or whatever.
Right,
you know,
right.
The great thing about movies is that they're like this window onto another world, this two-hour window on another world, and you want as few distractions as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So that's especially in that case. And I have to say that a lot of movies, more and more movies are being released, distributed by the streaming companies, Amazon, Netflix,
right.
Chief among them, and that is causing all sorts of controversies at film festivals and elsewhere. They are bankrolling these movies. They are getting people to see them, both in theaters, and they're getting people to see them through streaming, a much larger audience than would otherwise get to see them. Mm-hmm. That's all good. It's all still shaking itself out. That said, if you can see Roma on a big screen, see Roma on a big screen.
Certainly. So let's move on a little bit, Ty. I want to talk about some of the other big movies that came out this year. And let's start off by listening to a little bit of a film that was an instant hit when it came to theaters.
Do you write songs or anything?
I don't sing my own songs.
Why?
Almost every single person that I've come in contact with in the music industry has told me that my nose is too big and that I won't make it.
Your nose is beautiful.
And so that, of course, was from the trailer for A Star is Born, starring Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper, who also directed this one. So, Ty, this movie got a lot of attention, even though it was sort of a commercial film, which that was surprising to me. When it first came out, I was like, oh, it's Lady Gaga in a movie, like Bradley Cooper. It's another romance musical drama. But this was really more than that, it seems like.
It was. And it's nice to be reminded that there are good, big, broad appeal movies that are well made and that have real, you know, real emotional depths that can really speak to audiences and aren't just product. I think everybody was surprised when A Star is Born came out, because it's been made five times, if you count the very first version, mm-hmm. called What Price Hollywood. And the last one with Barbara Streisand and Kris Kristofferson, I hate to say, is not a very good movie. So, you know, and this one stars an actress who has never held down a major motion picture before. Mm-hmm. All sorts of reasons why it could have gone wrong. I maintain that the first hour of this Star is Born is some of the best mainstream filmmaking I've seen all year. For my money, it gets a little formulaic once she hits it big. And, you know, there's only so many places the story can go. But that first hour, when they're meeting, when she's walking up that ramp and she's singing a Judy, you know, she's singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow and this title sort of bleeds across the scene, or when she lies down on the bar and turns her face toward the camera, and Bradley Cooper, and that whole scene where they're sitting outside the all-night supermarket, just that just feels privileged and intimate and real in a way that few movies do. So I was really glad to see that, and I was glad to see a lot of people see that.
Mm-hmm, for sure. And what about Bradley Cooper's directing skills? I mean, what'd you make of those?
I think he's a pretty good director. I think he studied, he's on record as being a fan of, you know, Scorsese, Coppola, the new Hollywood filmmakers. And you can see that certainly in his visual style. I think, you know, I don't think he's at that level yet, but give him a couple more movies. It's a more than credible first effort.
So, Ty, let's talk about a film that you actually suggested to me, Death of Stalin. And
yes,
it is a hilarious political satire about Soviet leader Joseph Stalin's death and the melee that follows among the members of his central committee afterwards. So let's listen to a clip from that.
Now that we're quiet, I propose we call a doctor.
All the best doctors are in the gulag or dead.
What are people's thoughts on getting a bad doctor?
What if he recovers and finds out? Well, if he recovers, then we got a good doctor. And if he doesn't recover, then we didn't, but he won't know.
Doesn't that sound logic?
You know, and one thing I love about this movie, you can tell immediately that's Steve Buscemi. There's nobody who sounds like Steve Buscemi, and he's playing Khrushchev. And Michael Palin is in this. This is Soviet history as written by the Monty Python gang. And what's especially wonderful about the movie is that it does not sugarcoat the absolute horror and brutality of that particular government and that, you know, and that dictatorship and the people who maintained it. It is, I think I said in my review, you laugh till you bleed. It is written and directed by Armando Iannucci, who is one of the best, finest political satirists of our age. He did a great political comedy called In the Loop, and of course he does Veep. Veep, the TV show, is his creation. This is him taking his gloves off and having at history. So it is historically true. There's so much of this movie that's true. Do you remember the opening scene where the orchestra has to play an entire symphony again because Stalin wanted a recording of it.
Yeah, yeah. And the original conductor like passes out because he's so nervous.
Exactly. That actually happened. Mm-hmm. That is true to history. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot more. The performances, I think, are a joy. Simon Russell Beale, who is a British actor I was unfamiliar with, plays Beria, who is the most ruthless, most bloody-handed, not a nice person, and nor does the movie make him seem like a nice person. But the movie's really about what happens when, in a dictatorship, the dictator dies and all the toadies under him have to jockey for power. And it's not pretty, but it is hilarious.
I love that scene where they're sitting around the table and they're trying to make some decision. And they're all hesitant to raise their hands for the actual vote. And then they look around like everyone's lowering their hands, raising their hands. And it's really funny. I mean, what do you make of this? Like, what's the benefit of turning history and kind of a dark history into comedy?
A very dark history. Well, like all great satire, it emphasizes what incredible fools humans are. It emphasizes the worst aspects of our nature by making fun of them. When you laugh at a dictator, you take away its power. That applies to Stalin. It also applies to any larger-than-life egos in politics you might think of. Is the movie relevant today? Yes, it is. I would just say that the more you laugh and understand the people who might be running your lives, I think the worse for them and the better for you.
So one more movie I want to ask you about, Ty, is one of the biggest movie moments of the year. Let's take a listen.
Maybe we can still heal you.
Why? So you can just lock me up? No. Mm-hmm. Just bury me in the ocean. With my ancestors that jumped from the ships. Because they knew death was better than bondage.
So that, of course, is the scene from Black Panther when Killmonger dies. And oh my goodness, that last line.
Yeah.
I think that stuck with everyone who was in the theater. And so, you know, Ty, that Black Panther was obviously this Marvel comic coming to life. And it was this huge cultural moment because it was really a big celebration of on-screen diversity. Mm-hmm. And that's a big thing we saw with a lot of this year's movies, be it Black Panther, Black Klansman, Sorry to Bother You, Crazy Rich Asians, Call Me by Your Name. You know, the list goes on. Mm-hmm. So what is that, these moments that we saw over the year, what does that say about how Hollywood is changing, even if the change is gradual?
I will say that Black Panther, I think, was in certain ways the most important cultural moment of all of those you're talking about, because it was this huge popcorn hit and a huge box office hit. And in Hollywood, at the end of the day, you know, you can have all the Oscars you want. Money matters. Money speaks louder. And speaking as a white viewer, sitting in a theater where I was in the, you know, a rough minority of the audience, and feeling that theater come alive because those moviegoers saw themselves on screen in a way they had never had before, was a joyful experience. Mm-hmm. It was impossible to not get picked up in that joy, mm-hmm. That excitement. And you know, it almost overshadowed the quality. I think the movie's really good.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's the greatest movie ever made or the greatest superhero movie. I think it's really good. It's a superhero movie. It has to stick to certain formulas. That said, one of the things that I do appreciate about franchise movies of late is that they have been hiring directors who have distinct idiosyncratic visions and really good filmmaking skills, as opposed to just people who get the product done. So I'm thinking of Rian Johnson in the Star Wars movie, and certainly Ryan Coogler. I guess they have to be named Ryan. Ryan Coogler for Black Panther, because it's his vision that permeates Black Panther and makes it more than just a really good superhero movie, but makes it speak to a larger cultural moment. And a lot of that has to go to the screenwriting, of course. And Coogler was one of the writers as well. Mm-hmm. But the casting as well. This is a movie whose villain was almost more sympathetic than the hero.
Exactly, yeah. I think viewers, I definitely had that moment of like, well, who do I side with here?
Well, and that's the thing. How often do you see a superhero movie where the villain actually has valid emotional historical reasons, so much so that you kind of go, well, you kind of got a point there. Mm-hmm. And I think that spoke to all audiences, any audiences with their eyes open and have any sort of, you know, passing knowledge of history. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that makes that movie so powerful. The other thing that makes it so powerful is just the casting up and down, the visualization. It is a rich, rich, rich movie.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're going to talk about the movie Crazy Rich Asians a little later in our show, but what did you make of that one? I mean, this was one that was a rom-com, but it was also this huge cultural moment.
Yeah, why can't rom-coms be huge cultural moments? I mean, when Harry Met Sally is a cultural, you know, touchstone. Of course, in fact, it's those, you know, you could say that Titanic is a romantic drama, on a large boat that's sinking. I mean, it wasn't because of the boat that people went back and to see it over again. It was for Leo. So there's, you know, those popcorn movies, when they're done well, can really speak to a moment and bring in audiences. I thought Crazy Rich Asians was a better cultural moment than it was a movie. I thought it was a perfectly fine romantic comedy. I think it spoke more specifically to Asian Americans than it did to non-Asian Americans. I know that, you know, I've read about that final Mahjong scene and the layers of meaning in the tiles that a non-Asian American audience would not pick up on. And so I was glad to have it explained to me. So those things can really resonate, again, to an audience and make them feel like they're part of the larger culture.
For sure. Well, thank you so much, Ty. That's Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr. Ty, we really appreciate you coming in.
Thanks, Paris. Pleasure to be here.
Stay with us. Coming up, more about the movies, why Crazy Rich Asians struck a chord with so many people. I'm Paris Alston. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to a special edition of Radio Boston. I'm Paris Alston. We're talking about films this hour, fun films, and films that made a mark on our culture. Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr just talked about his favorites this year, including the romantic comedy Crazy Rich Asians. It's a story of a young Asian American woman who travels with her boyfriend to his best friend's wedding in Singapore, where she also meets his family, and that's where she finds out that he's rich. Here's a clip from the trailer.
Rich, we've been dating for over a year now, and I think it's about time people met my beautiful girlfriend. What about us taking an adventure each? Singapore, Colin's wedding. Don't you want to be my family?
So your family is rich?
We're comfortable.
That is exactly what a super rich person would say.
The movie has since gone on to become the highest-grossing romantic comedy in a decade, but it was more than just a love story. It was a moment for us to talk about why diversity on the big screen matters. Back in August, Radio Boston's Jamie Bologna spoke about the film with author Gish Jin, producer Michael Toe, and Boston artist-in-residence Karen Young.
I actually had some feelings before going in because I don't really like romantic comedies.
it's not everybody's cup of tea.
Exactly. But to see the range of characters on the screen was fantastic, and there was such a buzz around my community, and I loved seeing everything after the film that came out in terms of the articles, you know, article after article written by Asian and Asian Americans. There's such a buzz everywhere about it.
And Gish Jin, what about you?
Well, you know, I of course I share all the excitement. I mean, this is a huge moment, and you know, from the point of view of representation and so on. I also thought that there were some real breakthroughs from a story point of view that have not much been talked about. You know, so I don't know if you want to get into the story yet or if you want to check with Michael first. But I will say that just from a narrative point of view, there's some really interesting things about this movie.
Yeah, well, I think we'll get to that in a moment. And Michael, I want to play a clip of tape here for you of Stephanie Fu. She's a radio producer who's worked on This American Life and Snap Judgment. And she spoke with Vox's Today Explained podcast, and she talked about the importance of this film for her from her perspective and how she wished it had come out sooner. Let's listen.
I wonder if I had seen Crazy Rich Asians earlier, if I would have understood that there were a lot of ways to be an Asian, because in American media, the only image of an Asian American was this perfectly assimilated, basically just a white person, but Asian. They were obedient, they were elegant, they were beautiful, but they weren't that complicated. And I was very complicated.
Michael Toe, can you relate to that feeling?
Sure. I mean, I've seen, you know, growing up in the U.S. and fourth generation American, it's, you know, everybody that I saw that looked like myself on TV was very stereotyped, never fully fleshed out, never well-rounded, usually as a female, usually very hyper-sexualized, Asian males. A movie which actually showed normal, you know, Asian American people. It was really impactful. I saw it four times before the before I had to leave on my trip. So it was very meaningful for me.
Wow! How many times have you seen it, Karen?
Twice.
So Gish, you were saying that this movie is proving to be a sort of a big cultural moment in your view, and particularly in how some of the scenes played out. And again, spoiler alert, we're going to talk a little bit about the movie. Let's not give everything away. But, you know, it comes on the heels of films like Black Panther. It's a superhero film with a minority black cast that became a cultural moment for African Americans. And so I'm wondering, from your perspective, Gish Jin, how this movie is shaping the cultural moment.
Well, I think that there are two things. One thing is that I was just thrilled and amazed to see that opening scene. And I think a lot of Asian and Asian Americans, I'm sure, felt the same thing I did, which they have never seen on the screen, you know, the kind of discrimination that even rich people can face.
And for our listeners, do you mind briefly describing the opening scene?
Sure. This is the moment when this uber-rich Singaporean family comes into a British hotel, and because they've walked through the rain, they're kind of all wet, and they're turned away, even though they have a reservation. And, you know, this kind of blatant discrimination, to see that on the screen, something that so many people have experienced, you know?
And in the first moments, right?
I mean, you know, I mean, to me, that was just huge. And I will say also that, you know, it explains for those of us, you know, who are not familiar with Asian Americans, what the issues are. You know, the tremendous defensiveness that Asian and Asian Americans do feel. And if you want to know why they feel they have to amass these enormous amounts of money, why do they feel they all have to go to Harvard? You know, why? Well, there it is in that first scene, because, you know, most of us have faced that discrimination, and most of us are not then able to turn around and buy the hotel. And I think that, you know, I just think that first scene says so much about what it means to be Asian or Asian American. And I think I have to say that one thing that I was surprised about in the movie was that, you know, Eleanor Young never says, you know, to her son Nick, who wants to marry, you know, out of their system, you know, something like, you know, who would you be, you know, without your looks and without your class and without all that money?
Right.
You know what I mean? I mean, you know, how do you think that you would be treated if you did not have all that stuff to protect you? And that's basically what she stands for. And I think in the movie, she's sort of, you know, presented a little bit as standing for a tradition. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's important, too. But it's really more than that. It's really saying, you know, we have this shell and to protect us. And we depend on people like you to continue that protection, and where would we be without it? And if I may go on for another thing, which I thought extremely an incredible breakthrough in this movie, is that, you know, we, you know, as the, you know, the whatever, the general American audience,
uh-huh.
I mean, you know, are asked to identify with Rachel Chu, you know, and that is, she is the, you know, the economics professor from NYU, who inadvertently stumbles into this world.
Right. We heard a little bit from her in the trailer clip there at the top. Yep.
And so, you know, so Rachel Chu stumbles in, and, you know, there's a way in which, you know, in most narratives, you know, there's like the white person, you know, through whose eyes we see this foreign world, you know, and we as an audience accept her as our viewpoint, our view in. Even though she's Asian. So Asian American. I mean, there's a way in which she is accepted as a quote unquote, you know, white character.
Right, right. And Karen Young here in the studio is she's nodding her head here to what you're saying.
I mean, that is a huge, huge thing.
Yeah, I think that is a big thing. I think I identified with her as someone who's not in the uber wealthy, you know, class,
right.
And that was, you know, like, so everything she was looking at, I was also like had my jaw open the whole time.
Michael, what about from your perspective?
I mean, no doubt it's been an amazing movie to see ourselves on screen. Most of the times, you know, this is the last big Hollywood movie that showed an Asian American family was 25 years ago with Joy Luck Club.
Right, and it's a very different movie.
Smaller, very different movie. But that's what we have to compare to, because there's been nothing in between. There, you know, if there are films with Asian characters, they're very stereotyped. They're martial arts. They're the sidekick. There are smaller budget films. But this is a Hollywood film made for the American audience, the world audience, in the masses. And to see people that look like myself, that people that look like my daughters on screen was so powerful.
And why do you think it took so long, 25 years, to get another major Hollywood film like this?
Hollywood works in a really kind of a old boy network. And it's kind of like following what has done well in the past, and taking risks is hard. It's hard to take risks in Hollywood because they're investing so much money. And so in the past, it's always, well, we need a Matt Damon, we need a Scarlett Johansson. And even though there's been a lot of data that's been against that, Hollywood kind of stays in that same cycle again and again and again. And that's why having this film to actually break through, to show that it does, you don't need necessarily a Caucasian lead to hold a movie. You don't need necessarily showing diversity in films can be a huge success in the box office. And that's what we at Toro Oliver Films, we want to change that view of Hollywood. And
right.
This movie does that.
Well, at the same time, a lot of folks have mentioned that, you know, we aren't just talking about the 1% here in this film.
Yes.
It's the top 0.0001%. And there's a certain, I don't want to call it whitewashing, but there's only maybe one type of Asian that is presented in a Singaporean society that is very diverse. And Karen Young, I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I guess one thing, yeah, so I don't know anyone who comes close to that.
Yeah.
That's true. But, like, I do feel like the one thing that I really liked is that the film had so many different kinds of personalities and characters. And I think that one thing that really struck out to me is like the different stories of the women mm-hmm. in the film. Looking at Eleanor's character as the discouraging mom, the disapproving mother, but was also like criticized by her mother-in-law, you know, and seeing her humanness a little bit, I thought was really important. And I think seeing Rachel in the end sort of take a stand at the very end, I thought was really important as well.
So it doesn't concern you then that really this movie is about a very small subset of people within Singapore society.
Well, I think that is something that, we haven't talked about anything that we had trouble with the film. There were
please tell me some of your problems.
For sure. I definitely felt like the glamorization of that kind of wealth is something I had to have a lot of trouble with. You know, I think $40 million for a wedding is ridiculous, you know, but
right.
I'd say that about weddings in general. I don't know how the diamond got to be so important in the world, but that was, you know, one of the number one things that I had trouble with. I definitely had trouble with, you know, the characterization of darker skinned, you know, Asians in mm-hmm. the movie. But that doesn't.
And there were very few.
Yeah. Yeah. But then they were also very targeted as like being
right.
scary. Right. But it just like I do see like, you know, the actors, the writers, like everybody who's involved. This is definitely a movement, you know, for artists and Asians in the diaspora as well. But yeah, it definitely felt like it just portrayed one segment. And I don't think we should glamorize that group of folks.
I couldn't agree more. And let me just sort of say that, you know, a lot of Singaporeans, you know, really took issue with this movie. And I can see why. I can certainly see why. At one point, you know, I saw somebody online sort of said, no one speaks Singlish, of course, which is spoken all over Singapore,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, that is really quite a problem. We don't see the faces. We don't see anybody who's not super rich. And, you know, somebody sort of said, you know, since we're talking, we talk all the time about cultural appropriation, said, you know, basically they've appropriated Singapore, you know, and that, you know, that's a tough charge, but I think there's some truth to it. Now, I will say, you know, on the other side, I will say that it is true that an early project like this bears a really kind of almost surreal, burden of representation.
Well, right, and I want to bring Michael Toe back into the conversation.
The criticisms are pretty bad. Well, if I can just finish, I mean, I will say that, you know, to me, watching this and thinking about the criticisms, so reminded me of the huge criticisms that attended the publication of The Woman Warrior in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was so interesting the way that, that book could not have been more controversial because, you know, everybody wanted it to represent, you know, Chinese Americans, you know, the whole thing. And it was so interesting that, you know, fast forward a couple of decades, you know, Mulan comes out and, you know, do we see big protests? No, we see none. And what's happened? Well, what's happened is that the context has changed. So instead of one book, we now have so many books and so many movies that, you know, the burden is no longer there.
Well, yes, right. And Michael Toe, what about this idea that...
critical, but I think that will change over time.
Michael Toe, what about this idea then that we may be expecting too much from a rom-com?
Sure. That's what happens when you don't have another movie. It's been 25 years since the movie, so everyone, you know, it's supposed to represent everybody. But, you know, this is a huge, huge start for Asian Americans on screen. It's not the end. It's the beginning. And sure, it's not going to make everyone happy, but it is a huge start. And what better way than being the number one movie for the week? Than beating out all these other big name, films led by big actors, and really being a big start to what hopefully is much more diversification, much more representation of Asians in Hollywood.
That was Michael Toe, actor and producer at Toe Arboleda Films, speaking to Radio Boston's Jamie Bologna. He was joined by Karen Young, Boston artist in residence and founding director of The Genki Spark, and author Gish Jin. Stay with us. Coming up, we go back to middle school with Bo Burnham's Eighth Grade. I'm Paris Alston. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to a special edition of Radio Boston. I'm Paris Alston, and all this hour, it's everything movies. We've heard Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr's must-see movies and talked about the crazy success of Crazy Rich Asians and what it means. The film Eighth Grade didn't make quite as big a splash, but it also struck a deep chord with an honest, sensitive look at a young girl, Kayla, as she is trying and sometimes failing to navigate her last year of middle school with grace. The actress, Elsie Fisher, who earned a Golden Globe nomination for playing Kayla, explained to WBUR's Here and Now why her character was relatable.
There are so many teen stories, quote-unquote, that, again, are, like, played by adults or these perfect teenage actresses. But I feel like teen stories don't need to be aspirational. You shouldn't want to be, like, whoever the main character is. They should be honest. And I think that's what Kayla gives us.
Hamilton, Massachusetts native Bo Burnham made the film. Burnham is a comedian and actor who got his start on YouTube, and he told WBUR's Anthony Brooks that he wanted this to be a different tale of adolescence.
A lot of movies in this space tend to be remembered, and I like remembered movies, but I wanted to make a movie that was visceral, because I do believe the way that this age feels is different than the way it is remembered by adults, and I also think that kids are experiencing something different than I experienced in 2003 or someone experienced in another decade because of technology and because of the culture. So that was the inspiration, wanting to talk about the internet, wanting to talk about feelings around the internet, to maybe have a conversation about the internet that's a little subtler than Russia, or cyberbullying, to do a sort of a granular look at.
Well, I want to ask you about the internet, but I wanted just to focus on Kayla first. Mm. She's played by Elsie Fisher, clearly a smart and thoughtful girl, but she's not one of the cool girls. She's not one of the super popular girls, not one of the super pretty girls. And she spends a lot of time trying to be a better, more popular version of herself as she prepares for high school. Can you talk a little bit about her character, Kayla?
Yeah, I mean, she's voted most quiet, which was a superlative I had in my school when I was in middle school, which I couldn't believe that, like, parents would do that or teachers would do that because it felt like no kid self-identifies as shy. But yeah, it is someone who is seen as shy by the world but has a real want to express herself and better herself in the world, which I think everyone does to a certain degree. The movie's sort of about her in this last week of school making one final attempt to bridge the gap between where she thought she would be at this point and where she actually is. But hopefully, you know, it really is saying, you know, a 13-year-old girl can be a conduit for the human condition as much as a 60-year-old male poet in the woods can be.
Interesting. So talk about the effect of the internet, because you said you wanted to create a film that really showed what it felt like to be alive now. And one of the dominant forces in the world right now, particularly for these young people, are smartphones. They're glued to these devices. So how did you want to depict the effect of this technology on these kids?
Yeah, well, part of it was just that, just to depict the effect and to not prescribe, to not do a TED Talk. Sometimes when we talk about the internet, it feels like in culture we're talking about it prescriptively as parents, as worriers, rather than, for me, anyone that knows enough about the internet doesn't have any solid ground under their feet to talk about it. It feels like to know the internet is to be awash in it and drowning in it and grasping for meaning. Mm. So that's sort of the portrayal of it, to say, I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's good or bad. It's sort of neutral. It's two things at once. She's hyper-connected. She's lonely. She's overstimulated. She's numb. But she's these things at the same time. And it's just portraying what does it feel like to go to bed at the end of the day and to choose between every piece of information in the history of the world on your phone or the back of your eyelids. And that's what it sort of feels like, having to sweep between these two big binaries. And also, I think the internet does sort of force kids to watch themselves and not live in themselves. They sort of hover over themselves, watching themselves live their life, watch other people watch them live their life, watch other people watch them live their life. You know, there's a weird sort of meta, out-of-body, disassociative thing that happens. And the movie just hopefully portrays it in a little way and to show that the sort of classic things of being young, of wanting to be perceived as something, to want to change yourself, to be worried about the way peers think of you. The internet just really...
It really reinforces that.
Yeah, and exacerbates. Everything's just bigger. It's not, and hopefully everyone can relate to it, but also be sensitive to the fact that something very strange is happening right now, and we're not really taking inventory of it.
The launch of your career was, you know, had a lot to do with the availability of the internet. And I was reading this New York Times profile that talked about you as if the monster turned on Frankenstein, in a way.
Yeah. It's very funny. Yeah, people think Frankenstein's the monster, but no, Frankenstein's the doctor.
That's true.
Yeah,
right,
you know, you were right. No, you had it right.
No, we had it right, yeah.
I haven't turned. It's just it's more that it's not the movie's not about, and then she threw her phone in the ocean and then she was happy, you know.
right.
It's not meant to indict the internet. It's just meant to talk about it honestly. And it means something to me. That's why I'm talking about it this way.
Yeah.
It's definitely, I don't want it to be scare tactic or anything, but I just want it to, you know, be described correctly.
Yeah. So when I see what these what social media, well, I mean, here's an example that you depict really well in the film. These kids are always glued. Their eyes are always down. And I don't actually want to pick on these kids. I think we adults are guilty of the same thing.
We've also made a really bad world for them to look up at as well. I mean,
that's an interesting way to put it.
You know.
But I was watching the film and I just wanted to scream, take your eyes off the screen and look at each other, talk to each other. Mm-hmm. And it sort of made me think, you know, is the genie out of the bottle for good, or can we somehow stuff it back in and sort of turn away or turn this to better effect?
I mean, I think the genie's out. I mean, some people think it's going to be cyclical and kids are going to unplug, but at a certain point, like, not everything's cyclical. Sometimes the Model T shows up and there are no more horses.
But
I think the movie talks about a sort of classic asymmetry between that you'd rather have 100 meaningless connections in front of you than one that's staring across from you at the dinner table. But they're not meaningless. That's the thing, too. Like, she is connecting with people online. She is expressing herself online. That is good. and it's bad. That's what I'm trying to at least portray with this thing, is that there, I don't have a resolution. I don't have a point of view.
Right.
That's probably a bad thing.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
When these 13-year-olds grow up to become social scientists, I'll be very curious to hear what they have to say about the internet.
Yeah.
But until then, it's just like, I feel like we should just sort of take inventory maybe of what's happening, you know, and then let them speak with authority on it, because I just don't think there's enough information to speak with authority on the internet yet.
How much did you see yourself in Kayla?
I see myself more in her now than I did then, truly.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, I was definitely wanting to express myself on the internet at that age, and she's doing that as well. I mean, when I was her age, there really wasn't an internet to express yourself on in the same degree. But
right.
My sort of anxiety didn't sort of awaken until I was probably a sophomore in high school. I think girls, on average, not to be cruel to the boys or whatever, but just tend to have slightly deeper experiences a little earlier, for whatever reason, maybe culturally imposed or innate, whatever. But yeah, I see myself in her. You know, I was having panic attacks, you know, backstage at the Schubert Theater instead of before a pool party in a bathroom. But the right. feelings are the same. And that was the hope, to say, look at this 13-year-old girl and say, I can see myself in you now. We are the same. We feel the same. It doesn't just have to be. This isn't a story about my younger daughter or my younger self necessarily.
So, interesting question. Kayla is so believable, and there's a sort of harsh realism to this film and a lot of raw, unfiltered feelings. And I'm thinking of one scene in particular. It's right before the pool party, and the girls are all sort of lined up for a photograph. And Kayla, obviously a little uncomfortable in her bathing suit and her body, is kind of hiding behind the other girls, and she kind of gets pulled out in front of them. No, Kayla, we got to see you too. Come on out. It was such a painful moment to watch. I felt so badly for her. But here's my question. How did you tap into that so well? I mean, you're a guy, and you really directed this girl really, really well.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't love pool parties. I wasn't, like, psyched about my body. I don't know if anyone is in eighth grade. But, yeah, it was, in terms of how I was directing a girl, it was, I mean, I was very aware of being a man in this position the entire time and just tried to subjugate myself to her truth and told her all the time, you know what this is, not me. You show me.
Yeah.
What it's like. You are the expert on this. And also just, again, to just trust that I could know her. Yes. Believing that I could understand her, let me understand her.
Right.
If I had approached her like this alien of a, you know, people write movies about World War I soldiers, you know what I mean? And like creatures that live in volcanoes. I can understand a girl, you know?
Yeah.
I felt that way.
How did you find Elsie Fisher? She was so good in this role.
Yeah, she's pretty special. I found a clip of her online being interviewed for something, and brought her in, auditioned every kid sort of under the sun. Every other kid, when they played the role, it felt like a confident kid pretending to be shy. She was the only one that felt like a shy kid pretending to be confident, which is the role. Yeah, it was really, there was never a second choice. It was like the lights were on when she read. And it really, to bring Frankenstein back, it really was that. It was like, it's alive for the first time when she read it.
That's great. So I was talking to my very great producer, Zoe, who's your age, and she said something really interesting about this film, that it's really the only one that depicts in a real way how young people are using the internet and social media. And given how prevalent all this is in our society, why is that? I mean, do you agree with that? I mean, there are not a lot of films out there that really delve into it the way you have.
Yeah, that's nice. Well, thank you, Zoe. I think a problem I see with the internet portrayed in media is that it's always portrayed too significantly. If they're going to portray the internet, it'll be a huge plot device. Something will go viral. I want it, like, I'm very happy to have a movie where someone doesn't go viral. As opposed to just having the internet be atmosphere, part of their life.
Yeah.
Just something that's happening, not something that is immediately significant. It's not like, oh, I sent a picture here, or, oh my gosh, I FaceTime my mom by accident. Like, it's like these things just exist. So I think that's the hope, I think, of the movie, is that it just portrays it without commentary. It portrays it as it is in our lives, which is already integrated. When sometimes you see kids in movies and they're going like, oh my gosh, that was hashtag savage. And you're like, no, kids don't talk like that. Like, that's how a 40-year-old thinks a kid talks. It's integrated way more subtly into their life. They're not thinking about it. I think as younger people that actually grew up with the internet, like me, start to make things, you will see the internet be portrayed a little more emotionally and less as this, less satirized, because it's like, how do you why satirize the internet? The internet's already self-satirizing and ironic, and
right. It's sort of like, why satirize oxygen? I mean, it's just part of the atmosphere.
Yeah, and it's like, what are you going to do? You're going to satirize memes? You're going to satirize like a? It just doesn't make any sense. It doesn't go anywhere.
So, Bo, what are you working on next?
Hopefully, just taking some time off this and just sort of banging my head against a wall trying to think of something. I'm not good at multitasking, so it'll just be like sitting alone and trying to write again.
I'm really sort of glad to hear that. I'm really tired of talking to super talented people who are like finished one incredible movie and they're already telling me about the next one.
Oh, so, don't worry. You got a moderately talented person who's taking things one step at a time, baby.
All right.
That was Bo Burnham, comedian, actor, and director of the movie Eighth Grade, speaking to WBUR's Anthony Brooks. Thank you for listening to this special edition of Radio Boston. What were your favorite films of the year? Let us know at radioboston.org or tweet at us at Radio Boston. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Paris Alston. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.